This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Now, tonight, we're very lucky we have Kirsten Werner, who's going to speak to us tonight. Now, the National Museum is currently developing a new permanent gallery, and that's going to be called Creating a Country, and it's scheduled to be opened in late 2010. Creating a Country will trace a broad history of Australia, exploring significant themes in the nation's past through stories of Australian places and their peoples. That's a lovely broad title. I think that we're very lucky to have Kirsten here this evening because she will flesh that title out a little bit further for us. Kirsten is a senior curator with the National Museum, and she will outline plans for the new gallery and discuss how the curatorial team has approached the creation of a place-centred history of Australia. So please welcome Kirsten. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us tonight.
Well, thanks to Carolyn and the Friends for inviting me to come along and give a talk to you tonight. This is really the beginning in a whole series of talks that you'll be incredibly tired of by the end of them because they'll be running over really the next 2 years through until the opening of Creating a Country towards the close of 2010. So my job tonight as the senior curator on what's quite a large team of curators is to really try and give you a bit of an introduction to the new gallery called Creating a Country. And I thought what I might do is, as Carolyn's introduction made clear, Creating a Country has quite a broad mandate, I think you would say. It's tasked with developing and presenting a general history of Australia. Now, the question I always get asked when I explain this is, you know, how much room have you got? And I say, about, 1,200 square metres of exhibition space. And everybody always asks me, how do you decide what in the great kind of infinitude of stories that is the Australian past and its Australian experience, what do you choose to include? So I'm basically going to focus on that a little bit tonight. Of course, I will welcome your questions at the end about why we chose to put some things in and didn't choose to put other things in. I'm sure you'll have them. So as Carolyn said, Creating a Country has been in development for quite a little while now. It's been in development for about 3 years from the curatorial perspective. And we're currently just really shifting gear now as we actually move into the design phase of the project. That phase will continue really through this year into early next year, and then we'll really be into fabrication phase where we're actually building the gallery. Creating a Country is going to occupy the space in the museum that's currently taken up by the Nation Gallery, which I'm sure you will all know very well. So that's both the kind of the large ground floor area that's currently taken up by Nation, and then also the mezzanine up above it. All that area will basically be emptied and rebuilt from scratch. So you can see it's actually quite a big construction project, as large as quite a big curatorial and intellectual project. So as Carolyn noted, Creating a Country is tasked with presenting a general history of Australia. It will explore the distinctive social, economic and political conditions that have evolved in Australian society since European colonisation in the late 18th century, while also attending to the features of everyday life and popular culture as they have evolved over this time. So, of course, as you know, all the exhibitions within the museum explore histories of Australia. Together, they create a variety of frameworks and perspectives on the past. But I do think that we can expect, drawing particularly on our experience of how Nation has been understood over the last 5 years, that many of our visitors will interpret Creating a Country as the museum's major statement on our national history. This, I have to say, is no small task, as I said, within the amount of exhibition space we have. Indeed, I would say it's probably no small task in the context of any exhibition space. So this evening I'd like to talk about how the curatorial team have been developing Creating a Country. I'll look particularly at how we've interpreted this ambition to create a general history of Australia and how we've gone about selecting the stories to realise it from among the infinitude of stories that constitute the past. I'll introduce you to some of the people, places and especially some of the objects that we hope to include in the gallery to realise these stories. Now, I must say this is probably their first airing in a more public environment, sort of beyond the museum staff, so it'll be interesting to get your reactions. So all good exhibitions including, I think, all good histories, begin with a question about the nature of human experience in the past. For Creating a Country, we began by asking how people have responded to the challenges of living in the Australian continent. How have people encountered Australian landscapes, adapted to new physical and cultural realities, and developed distinctive social, political, and economic practices? We want to understand how people have experienced and are experiencing living in Australia and how they have sought to make their lives in the continent. And we want to do this in a way that captures both the breadth and diversity as well as the continuities in these experiences. So we began this whole process about what Create a Country was about by asking, what do we actually mean by a general history of Australia? It's no easy thing to succinctly describe and categorise Australian history. How can we structure the past? How do various structures privilege the experiences of certain Australians over others? What events do count as key and significant, and which are less important to basic historical understanding? I think if you asked 100 people, you would probably get 100 different answers. We did draw, I think, on a lot of work that had been done outside the museum on trying to basically structure an Australian history. And we really drew on this to actually develop a thematic structure for the gallery. We decided quite early on in the exhibition development to structure Creating a Country around 10 key themes. We envisaged that each of these themes would eventually find a physical reality in the exhibition as a module on the gallery floor, allowing the conceptual structure of the exhibition to map to the architectural structure of the display. So we conceptualised Creating a Country structure around the following 10 key themes, which I'm pretty sure when you get to see the gallery, you'll actually recognise as modules in the gallery space. On the Edge of the World, which examines moments of colonial foundation and the cultural encounters these precipitated, particularly those encounters in those early settlements between both European settlers and Indigenous people and between free settlers and bonded individuals within those societies. The Colonial Gaze, exploring practices and processes of exploration and settlement in the early phase of colonisation. Never Enough Grass, tracing the expansion of the pastoral industry, not the development of marijuana industry. Golden Chartism, looking at the 19th century gold rushes and the impact of mass immigration on changing social patterns. Land of Opportunity, exploring efforts to realise social justice and equal opportunities for all Australians. Extending the Farmlands, looking at agricultural development and innovation. Connecting the Nation, not surprisingly, communication and transportation networks. A Spirit of Inquiry, looking at practices in science, education and ideas. Post-war economies, tracing the diversification of the Australian economy after the Second World War, and particularly the growth in the manufacturing, mining and finance industries. They're not quite one industry. The Australian city, examining the growth of cities as sites for housing, work and leisure. Pretty broad topics. So once we'd come up with these themes, then we had to think through what they actually meant. We tend to see each thematic title not as a descriptor or a period, not as a descriptor of a period or a topic in Australian history, but rather as signifying an idea. By that I mean an ambition or a philosophy or a problem that has impelled people in their approach to living in this country. What did they actually want to do in Australia? What kind of society did they want to build? We envisage the exhibition as exploring how people have actively sought to make their lives in the continent, how and in pursuit of what goals they have acted in order to shape their places and their communities. So the Extending the Farmlands module, for example, traces the development of agriculture in Australia, but it does so through a particular philosophical lens. It asks how the trajectory of agricultural practice has been shaped by the yeoman ideal. That is, that by the belief that was imported to Australia by the very early British colonists, that the path to a stable, prosperous and moral society lay through the settlement of men and their families on small farms. This is actually a fascinating idea in the history of Australia. It's an idea that we can trace as shaping agricultural policy in the Tasmanian northern districts in the 1820s, in the impact of the Selection Acts in the 1860s, the funding of soldier settlement schemes in the wake of World War I and World War II, right through to corporate-driven agricultural development schemes, the big science schemes of the 1950s. And I think today we can continue to find the ideal of the yeoman farmer still informing our ideas about agriculture and about society, when we look at ideas about giving drought relief to farmers to keep them on the land, and in contemporary anxieties about the depopulation of rural areas. Well, you might have noted, I assure you have, that so far I've talked very little about interpreting national identity or about telling a national history, and I don't actually intend to start now. The museum is often understood as existing to define what it means to be Australian, or its job is to represent a national history, the story of Australia. I have to say, though, these aren't really frameworks that we have found particularly useful in developing Creating a Country. We decided early on that we wanted to avoid the kind of contested and circular discussions that often develop when you start talking about trying to define an Australian identity or a national character. We felt that this would lead the exhibition to representing concepts of Australianness that were singular and narrow and about which it was impossible to achieve a consensus. Similarly, while we wanted to look at historical experience across the continent, we wanted to avoid creating a historical narrative that featured an abstract nation as its protagonist, or that suggested the unfolding of an ahistorical national genius. In other words, we wanted Creating a Country to tell a general history, but not a generalised one. We wanted to avoid elevating particular experiences into abstract symbols of a shared, homogenous national experience. We identified place, or locale, as a powerful frame through which to explore historical experience in Australia. Rather than creating a country describing a national reach through defining or representing a national type or identity, we envisaged the gallery as bringing together a series of located histories. Indeed, that's the subtitle of my paper, which I never told you. It's called Located Histories. Each located history in Creating a Country will explore the conjunction of ideas, people and landscapes in particular times and places. In a sense, we're bringing together in Creating a Country a series of small histories that together suggest the sweep and variety of historical experience in Australia. So Creating a Country will be structured by 10 key themes, each exploring an idea or an ambition that has shaped people's choices and actions. Each theme will be interpreted through exhibits that explore historical experiences in three or four particular places. We will pay particular attention to the diversity of people encountering and engaging with each other at each place, and keep an eye on ensuring that places are drawn from across the continent. Taken together, these located histories will draw out continuities, but also differences of experience across the continent and across time, creating a national conversation, but not a singular national history. So let's talk that through a little bit as an example. So Never Enough Grass, which as I said looks at the development of pastoralism and particularly the drive for pastoral expansion through the 19th century and into the 20th century, will be explored through four places. The first of those is Springfield Station near Goulburn in New South Wales, and I think probably many of the friends are familiar now with Springfield Station because the owners of Springfield, as you know, made a really significant donation to the museum a couple of years ago of objects from their family. Bowen Downs up in Queensland, Springvale Station, which is near Katherine in the Northern Territory, and Derby and the West Kimberley Ranges in Western Australia. I should say Derby. If there's any Western Australians, I apologise. Now, to begin with, when we decided, okay, we're going to have 10 key themes, we're going to have three or four places per theme, we thought, well, you know, how do we actually decide what kind of scope of history we're going to address in each place? To begin with, we envisaged that our interpretation of each place would focus on a specific moment in time as well as the particular place. So to return to Springvale for a moment, we initially planned to focus interpretation on the founding of the station in 1879. 1879 is the year in which veteran overlander Alfred Giles arrived in the area after a long journey bringing 12,000 sheep and 2,500 cattle from South Australia. That's a long trip. This is Alfred Giles with some of his family and workers outside the Springvale homestead, which they built in 1879 and then in 1894 abandoned, defeated by Aboriginal resistance to their being there, but also the cattle tick, grass seeds and white ants, which basically drove them from the homestead. As we worked on Creating a Country, our initial intention to focus on a particular time has really blurred and dissipated. Really over the last couple of years, members of the curatorial team have been travelling really across the continent, visiting the places that we've identified, and talking with the communities that we anticipate featuring in the gallery. This has been really an incredible privilege for the Creating a Country staff to be able to invest the time and resources to really go out and connect with the communities we anticipate representing. And what's emerged from these encounters and from the discussions that have arisen out of those visits is a strong sense of how experience in place is connected across time and how it's possible to read in contemporary communities the legacies of past choices, ideas and challenges, as well as the ongoing power of the land to shape human action. So at Springvale, curator George May, who will actually talk to you next month if you can come, George visited Springvale about 18 months ago now, and in talking to people there, he discovered really a number of stories that connect the present in Springvale very deeply and complexly to the past. In the contemporary landscape at Springvale, traces remain of Giles' encounter with the local environment. George, for example, collected a timber fence post. I've got a rather blue picture there. A timber fence post, which has basically been eaten through by descendants of the white ants that attacked Giles' storehouse. And also, he kind of collected a whole series of examples of these incredible speargrass seeds that basically ruined Giles' cattle and sheep. They worked their way as the cattle and sheep moved through them. These incredibly kind of tough seeds, which have little sort of spirals on them, would actually like work in underneath the animal's wool or hair and penetrate the skin and actually kill them internally. It's quite horrific and really not at all expected by Giles when he went that way. So materials like this will feature in Creating a Country, both evoking the landscape around Springvale and bringing into the present some of the local factors that so profoundly shaped Giles' historical experience. In Springvale, George also explored remaining evidence of Alfred Giles' unhappy encounters with the local Jaywon and Agamon people. This is the door to Giles' homestead, complete on either side of the doorway with gun ports included by Giles to enable defence of the building against Aboriginal attack. However, the story of the relations between settlers and local Aboriginal people is also not one that remains in the past. These relationships have evolved over time, and of course some forms of accommodation and cooperation have emerged. Elsie Station, for example, was settled just to the north of Springvale in 1881, and Alfred Giles' son Harold became its manager in 1928. Mangari woman Amy Diangug, and I think my pronunciation is terrible there, worked in the homestead as a cook, and this glass beaded armband, which is quite tiny, she made in the 1930s, suggests her attachment to both Elsie Station and to her own traditional cultural practices. This is a type of object which Amy's people made for boys to wear during initiation ceremonies, so quite a kind of specific kind of cultural object. But its design features HTT, which is the Elsie brand. So this object, which has been very kindly donated to the museum, is also one of those objects that will come into Creating a Country to represent the complexity of encounters in that place. So through objects such as this and their stories, Creating a Country will ask visitors to imagine experience in a particular place and to consider how the experiences of many different people living in a place are connected through time. In many of the exhibits, visitors will be invited to explore the history of a locale backwards and forwards in time, perhaps beginning at an especially historically significant or just plain dramatic moment, such as Giles' arrival at Springvale in 1879, but then also tracing how this moment emerged out of and fed into longer social and environmental histories. As I described earlier, each theme or module in Creating a Country explores the history of three or four places. So in Never Enough Grass, as I said, we've got those four places. And visitors will be able to explore how the drive to expand Australia's pastoral industry brought settlers into close engagement, although they were all after the same thing, as they engaged with very different environments, animals, plants and peoples. They had very different experiences and developed very different kinds of responses. We hope that visitors will be able to recognise the particular conditions of experience in places, but also consider similarities and differences in experience between different places. Right. Well, so far, strangely for a curator, I've talked in rather a conceptual matter about developing Creating a Country. But in a sense, this has really a bit misrepresented our process for developing the exhibition. Exhibitions, of course, are not books. They're not anything except exhibitions, actually. They're very distinctive forms of history making, defined by the purposeful arrangement, display of objects in three-dimensional environments. Meaning in an exhibition, history in the sense of being in an exhibition, is made as visitors move through the display space, encountering evidence of the past, connecting together objects, images, sound and text, and asking what these artefacts can tell us about the experiences of other people. You really make his meaning in the exhibition. I believe a focus on place, or rather on objects in place, will allow this kind of sense about meaning-making in the exhibition to really come into its own. Objects embody, in many ways, information about the past that is highly specific to their own particular histories of manufacture, use and circulation. You can display objects as talisman or hooks for more abstract general themes, but I think that this tends to obscure the communicative power. It's really only when we attend to the particular history of an object that we begin to understand and feel how they illuminate the past. This, for example, is a stream anchor. It's a lot bigger than the picture makes it seem. If you look very closely, and I hope you can see well enough, you'll notice that elements of it, it's not in very good condition. It's weathered and flaking. At one end is the remains of a cable, which is evidently snapped off. The question is, why does it look like it does? It's basically because it spent 170 years at the bottom of the sea. In May 1803, Matthew Flinders, en route around the continent in the Investigator, put into Middle Island in the Recherche Archipelago of what is now Western Australia. He had 4 peaceful days resupplying the ship, and then, unfortunately, a gale blew up, and Flinders was obliged to cut loose both his stream and his bow anchor to prevent the Investigator being wrecked against the rocks. This anchor, the stream anchor, then remained, and the other one as well actually, remained on the seabed off Western Australia until 1973, when they were recovered by members of the Underwater Explorers Club. Personally, I think the best named club in the entire history of the planet, the Underwater Explorers Club. So the materiality of this anchor, something about its condition, and when you look closely at it, this can embody its history. Flinders' experiences and something of the nature and history of the Recherche Archipelago. I think as visitors begin to engage with the mystery of the anchor's appearance, they can begin to imagine Flinders' experiences on the wild swells of the Southern Ocean. They might ask, you know, where was he? What was it like there? What was he doing there? Who was he with? Was he the first European to visit these shores? Did he meet the locals? What did he take away with him? In Creating a Country, we are going to be displaying Flinders' stream anchor in the Colonial Gaze module. This module focuses on practices of exploration and settlement in the early colonial period, but through located histories linking objects to place, we can also ask visitors to consider how practices of exploration of 170 years ago still resonate today. The stream anchor, which has actually been in the museum's collection for quite a long time, but until recently has been on sabbatical in Western Australia, the stream anchor directs us to the fabulous landscape of the Recherche Archipelago. When we look more broadly, more ethnographically, if you like, I have to throw that in since I'm an anthropologist, not a historian, when we look more broadly at Flinders and his crew's actions in the archipelago in 1803, we can begin to understand how his voyage was about exploration, but also how it was about mapping and natural history and empire building and the trade in sea oil. In The Investigator, we find not only Flinders, but also naturalists Ferdinand Bauer and Robert Brown, mineralogist John Allen, landscape painter William Westall, marine Benjamin Morgan, and seaman Jack Wood, not to mention Trim the Cat. If we look more broadly at who was it that was visiting the Recherche Archipelago, and indeed who was it that had to participate in that decision to cut loose the anchor, a rich kind of variety of material culture emerges from that moment in time. And here's just a few of the items that come. The stream anchor, Flinders' fantastic atlas of the mapping the coast of Australia, specimens and eventually drawings by Brown and Bauer of the flora of Australia, and I've always loved the memorial statue of Trim, who those of you who have been up to the State Library of New South Wales, which is where the original sits. Drawing on our focus on place, we can move in Crania Country out from Flinders' encounter with the Recherche Archipelago to explore how the ambition to explore has shaped human interactions with the archipelago more broadly. We might begin, for example, and I think this is probably what we're going to be doing, begin the exhibit narrative around the archipelago with material from the 1803 expedition, such as this original botanical specimen which was collected by Flinders' companion Robert Brown, which is actually in the National Herbarium in Victoria, but they're very kindly going to lend it to us. We might then invite visitors to consider this Cape Barren Goose specimen, which was actually collected 100 years after Flinders in a collecting expedition sponsored by the Western Australian Museum. And then perhaps we might also include material relating to the 2002 project called Marine Futures, in which a local community organisation called the Research Advisory Group began working with the University of Western Australia to create a comprehensive record of the seafloor of the archipelago. This is really the contemporary way of collecting in the archipelago, not to shoot things and take them home and stuff them, but rather to use an underwater camera, which has come into the collection, to create the footage from which this still is taken. Much nicer to the geese, I think. Creating a country will live and breathe, I think, through its displays of collections, and the process of identifying collections to use in the exhibition has strongly informed the choice of which places we will feature in the gallery. In truth, any place in Australia could feature in Creating a Country, with many able to find a home in many of the themes. But we cannot tell a story about a place if we have no artefacts to display. So how then have we chosen which places to feature in Creating a Country when it opens in 2010? Well, it is important that the exhibition includes at least some of the more recognisable and well-known places, events and moments in Australian history. A significant portion of our visitors expect that when they visit the museum, they will learn about events such as the British landing at Port Jackson in 1788 or the Eureka Uprising in the 1850s. Others will expect treatments of significant projects, such as the Trans-Australia Railway and the Snowy Mountains Hydroelectric Scheme, or powerful social movements such as the struggles for female suffrage or equal pay for Aboriginal Australians. Obviously, we can't include at any one time, and I say it now, we can't include all the better-known historical landmarks that some visitors will expect. But we certainly plan to include some of them and include more of them over the 10-year life of the gallery. We do hope, however, to provide something of a fresh take on these recognisable events through asking how they emerge from the encounters between different peoples in place. The Snowy Mountains Scheme, for example, is often interpreted as either a triumphal tale of national infrastructure development or something of a workers' paradise populated by new migrants. Exhibitions about the Snowy Mountains Scheme often include objects, such as this model of the Snowy Mountains Scheme, which I actually also think is fantastic. This is a model that was presented to Prime Minister Ben Chifley at the opening of the scheme. You can actually plug it in and little lights light up to show you where the dams are. Or, for example, this worker's helmet, which comes from a worker who worked on the scheme. And you can see these fantastic kind of images that go along with that, give a sense of the great sort of majesty of the worker within the scheme. Engineering and labour are certainly strong aspects of the history of the Snowy, and we will be including objects such as this. But when we look at the complexity of the located history of the Snowy, we also discover other stories. Histories of loss and longing, for example, that were lived by the residents of Old Anamunipi who were obliged to leave their homes to make way for a lake. This, for example, is obviously a picture of Anamunipi before the flooding and a tiny collection of rusted toys that were actually somehow left behind when residents left and were then recovered by residents who moved from Old Anamunipi to a new Anamunipi, perhaps 30 years after the lake was flooded. There are also histories, for example, of scientific ingenuity and frustration that emerge from the backroom work of building technology such as SNOCOM, the Snowy Computer, which is in the museum's collection. This is it gloriously in storage because we haven't managed to set it up yet, but a great photo of it actually in use. SNOCOM was really built to develop much of the engine, to work out much of the engineering parameters around building building elements of the Snowy scheme. Creating a Country will also feature places that were suggested by the thematic structure for the gallery. As I've already mentioned, extending the farmlands module, for example, explores the yeoman ideal as it has shaped agricultural development in Australia. We know from historical scholarship that the influence of this ideal could be strongly identified in the 1860 Selection Acts that sought to break up large pastoral runs and impose World War I soldier settlement schemes. So we saw places in Australia in which these policies had had a strong impact, eventually settling on Wagga Wagga in central western New South Wales and Cardamom in the wheat belt of Western Australia. 3 years ago, the museum didn't really hold very strong collections relating to these places in the context of this theme. But curatorial engagement with these communities is generating new material for the exhibition. To talk again about George Main, who's been working on the exhibition for a long time, George, for example, some months ago visited Kanama, talking there with descendants of soldier settlers, some of them still working at their ancestors' farms. This, for example, is Bruce White, who still works Rosedale, a property settled by his grandfather after World War I. We hope to borrow from these families a range of small, rather personal and touching items that reflect their experience of life on a soldier settlement farm, and I think particularly their experience of them being soldier settlement farms. What's interesting about these families is that very many of them have kept similar kinds of objects. For example, World War I medals feature large, but also very much photographs, such as this wonderful one of Tom White, and a piece of well-travelled shrapnel, which came back with Bruce's grandfather from the First World War and stayed in his foot, apparently, for quite a long period of time. As I said, many of these people on Kanama properties treasure objects such as these medals and photographs. They're rather everyday objects which talk about memory of family and land. And we hope to display a series of these collections together with weightier objects such as farming technology that shaped everyday labour in the post-war period and sporting equipment, for example, that speaks to community life. We believe this approach will invite visitors to engage personally with the farmers' experiences and also consider the larger forces which connected these people with the land in this place. We also decided to include a number of places in Creating a Country simply because there existed a strong resonance between the thematic structure and the museum's existing collections. This is my favourite moment in the talk. This is the moment for the mystery object question. I'm referring to this object in the foreground of the photo. You have to kind of block out the car in the back. Does anybody want to take a guess about what this is? Come on, someone's got to guess waffle iron. Yes, at the back. Oh, no.
Printing press.
Printing press, not bad. Giant waffle iron, I think.
Is it a liner type setting?
No. Yeah, not for printing, actually. I'll give up. This is actually a knitlock tile-making machine. The museum has actually held for quite a long period of time two knitlock brick and tile-making machines, which were designed by architect Walter Burley Griffin in the 1910s and used in the 1920s as Griffin and his wife Marion Marney established or tried to establish their suburban vision at Castle Crag in Sydney. These knitlock machines provided a means, well, and certainly this was the aim, provided a means for landowners to cheaply build their own homes on Castle Crag blocks. Essentially, this was meant to be a machine where everybody could learn very quickly how to make your own bricks and tiles so you could build your own house. We decided to include Castle Crag in Creating a Country because of the opportunity to display and interpret, indeed to assemble, these intriguing machines, which is quite an interesting conservation work, I think, and use them as a way to explore the vision of a democratic urban community. Curator Daniel Oakman, who will be talking to you in a few months, has been working with Castle Crag residents, kind of talking about these machines and so on. And in response, the museum's holdings have really grown related to them. For example, we now own actually a kind of fabulous set of French windows, which are actually from this house. This is an old photo of the house, and the French windows were being removed because it was being renovated. This is a house called the Duncan House, and the Duncans were a family who moved into Castle Crag when Griffin and Marnie were there. They built a knitlock house, but they didn't really enjoy it all that much because apparently it leaked continuously, and it became a sort of, you know, characteristic feature of these houses that you had to be prepared to live in a swamp, essentially, is how one of the sons described it. But it is quite beautiful, I think. So wonderfully, we've acquired some interior fittings of the houses as they're being renovated. And we've also, through forming a fantastic relationship with the community, been given the opportunity to borrow for the exhibition these large puppets, which you can see in the bottom show, which are on the bottom slide, which are actually puppets representing Walter and Marion. And they have been used over really quite a long period of time now by Castle Crag residents actually demonstrating against redevelopment of the suburb. So they're very much about a continuation of a kind of sense about suburban life. They're kind of huge, like mad kind of papier-mâché things. So I think they'll really freak people out in the gallery, which is great. So what you can see, there's sort of a lot of kind of pressure circling around that help us decide how what creating a country is going to look like. From one perspective, we're kind of negotiating these intersecting demands to address recognised themes and milestones in Australian history. We want to provide a fresh take on the past and to avoid a kind of generalised and abstracted national history. We also need to maintain a representational breadth in the gallery in terms of its geographic and temporal coverage, and definitely, closest to my heart, display collections that we think will captivate, provoke and move our visitors, or indeed captivate, provoke and move us. These complex claims on the gallery are really just simply reflect the realities of working at the National Museum. The museum is a place for all Australians, and we really try to engage with a wide range of different audiences, from the young to the old, from the well-educated to those who have little knowledge of history, from those attending as part of a broader school program to folks who simply turn up for an afternoon while they're on holiday from Korea. Our hope in creating a country is to provide a number of ways, different ways, for visitors to engage with the content. Some may choose to follow the basically chronological path through the gallery that is established by the thematic structure and that shapes each module. Others might wander around enjoying encountering different places, while others still might pay more attention to exhibits that speak to their own experiences as urban dwellers or wheat farmers or suburban developers or the children of miners. From another perspective, and this is really strongly shaping the gallery, I think creating a country is developing as we engage with people around the country, talking to them about their places, about their communities, their families, their landscapes, and the artefacts that embody and express these histories for them. Over the next month, and here's my plug, curators from the Creating Country team will be presenting a series of Friends Talks that describe each of the modules that they've been working on. And I think we're really going to focus in those talks, if you like, on talking about the process, about research, about how we actually develop those modules and select certain things to finally appear in the gallery and figure out what we want to say about them. So, look, I hope you'll be able to make it along to some of them. We often find it helpful to imagine creating a country as offering visitors something of an imaginative tour of Australia, a tour in which visitors can encounter new and known places and engage with the objects that record and evoke how people have lived, engaged and sought to use and shape and build places. I thought I might conclude, rather than giving you an officious conclusion, is just to take you on a quick, somewhat vicarious tour of most of the places that will feature in Creating a Country when it opens. The fast tour of Creating a Country. That's all for me. I'd be more than happy to welcome to answer any questions. Or if indeed you want to know any more about sort of how we're thinking about or what objects we're thinking about in relationship to any of the places you've just seen. Thanks. I think you're being recorded, I think. No blasphemy allowed, that's
My question is about how you're envisaging to design the exhibition. I just want to make a comment about Australian Journeys, how, you know, the stories are lovely, but when there's a group in there, it's quite difficult to... I visit quite a lot with small to medium-sized groups, and when there's already a group in one of the sort of between two of the shards, if you like, it's quite hard to then move other people around. It's quite cramped.
Okay. So do you want me to comment on that or on how we're going to design?
How do you see that?
I think... Look, obviously it's something we're always aware of, is how we cope with the fact that there are times when the gallery is crowded and times when the gallery is empty. I do think Australian Journeys is a very intimate exhibition. It's really the content is intimate, and the intent is that it was designed to be encompassing, enclosing exhibition in terms of its design, which we feel suited the content, these kind of very particular intimate stories. So it was actually designed to create a sense that there wouldn't be too many people actually between the exhibits. Obviously, that does, completely agree that that does take a problem when you've got numerous groups in that space. But I would say equally, if we hadn't designed it that way, it would feel, if you were in there when there weren't a lot of people in there, it would feel incredibly cavernous and wouldn't actually work very well at all. I think that's what we're moving towards in the museum, and I think what we're really focusing on is trying to ensure that as the exhibitions are redeveloped, there's a strong sense of a different design experience, if you like, in each exhibition. So Creating a Country is an exhibition that is much more expansive in feel than Australian Journeys. It'll have, for example, a lot bigger objects with more space around them. So I suspect that what you may find is Creating a Country is an easier exhibition to move visitors through. I mean, I think probably Creating a Country will evoke a different kind of experience in visitors. I know when I've certainly been looking, for example, at how children react around large objects, is they like to run around and actually jump up and down and measure themselves against them and so on. And indeed, adults quite like to do that quite a bit. So we're designing Creating a Country with more the sense that this will be a different kind of physical experience in that space. So and I suspect that will mean that it's kind of easier to move various, I think particularly numerous small groups around. It's also, frankly, Creating a Country is about three times the floor space as Australian Journeys. Australian Journeys is a small space that had a strong pressure on it to, particularly at opening, to cover a certain scope of Australian history, and that's also contributed to us kind of deciding on that design solution.
Thank you. I was just wondering if you could explain something. You said this was a fresh take and it was also going to be provoking. What exactly is fresh about it and where's the provocative nature of it?
Yeah, look, I think it's fresh because I think a focus on place, which is, as I say, is not, we haven't invented looking at place as a framework for understanding history. It's, for example, it's quite strongly developed in heritage fields and so on. But it's been less developed in museum exhibitions, and particularly museum exhibitions that are tasked with doing kind of encompassing a national history, if you want to talk about it that way. So I think that it's fresh in that we are trying not to do, if you like, a kind of national history. We are trying to bring a kind of particularity of focus and a precision in our focus in understanding different experiences across Australia, and trying to really look at the way in which the accumulation of those located histories can be understood to constitute a history of Australia. I don't think that's been done extensively in museum exhibitions or indeed, I would argue, in, say, written history. I think the provocation comes in, for example, in the particular ways that what happens when you look at the different ways in which different groups of people have encountered each other in places. So, for example, to probably take the most obvious example, in many of the exhibits, indeed I would say in almost all of the exhibits, issues about relationships between Indigenous and settler relationships comes up in a quite a complex way. And I think what we've tried to do is be very precise about when those relationships are contested or when they are a response to kind of conflict on the frontier, or when they're a response to different competing ideas about what should be going on. And I think it's that idea about trying to be precise and open that to enable that when you have different groups kind of engaging in a similar place, often they're going to have very different ideas about what should be going on. For example, should we be clearing the 90-mile desert and trying to turn it into farmland? Well, yes, it's kind of in terms about if you want to think about agricultural development. Well, no, if you want to think about kind of some of the ecological consequences of that. We're trying in each of those places to allow both those kinds of perspectives, so say in that example, both those perspectives and experiences to come out and sit together in a way. And personally, I find in my experience from exhibitions is when you allow that to do in a precise way, but in an open way, that enables people to feel provoked into asking, how are these people relating to each other and what does that mean in terms of our bigger relationship to place?
Very much for your talk this evening. I think you've got a sense of place, and that's going to come through with your various exhibits. But the sense of time, if you're not going to have major historical timepieces, could you perhaps have an overview, a theme running around the whole thing, maybe a circuit of time that says Parliament was formed here or Constitution was here or whatever, so that people could look at the objects and their own little time trees, if you like, and then perhaps look up at something and say, ah, that was when this was going on or something like that. So it would give an overall sense of time that this small piece of country was developing and why it was developing like it did.
I think I don't want to give the impression that we won't be providing context for what's happening in each of those places. I think there are different ways to do that. I think it would be tricky to try and develop a single timeline, if you like, for how everything fits together in the gallery. However, I certainly don't want to give the impression that, for example, understanding why that we would want to provide the information that allows visitors to understand why, if you've got a kind of particular thing happening in Wagga Wagga, for example, the breaking up of pastoral runs or the arrival of the railroad, that we can't provide the information for those people who are looking for it to understand, you know, why that was happening then in a somewhat larger context, and to understand that Wagga Wagga is one way of understanding a process that's going on more broadly. And I do think that that's actually quite... Providing context is actually quite... you can do that quite efficiently because generally people are looking for a quick something to read to allow them to set it up, to slot it into their sense about a broader historical framework. So I don't want to give the impression that that's not going to be there in the exhibition. It's just it's not the kind of structuring, doing a kind of chronological or timeline structure of Australian history. It's not the overall structure of the exhibition as it's developing. Is there a guy down the front?
I commend you for tackling the job of bringing it down to 10 themes. That must have been a really interesting exercise.
Another 10 as well.
And I'd like to address one that me jumps out as missing, and perhaps you are covering in a different way. Or if I can ask a second type of question, perhaps you're leaving some of these things to other institutions. And the theme that I'm picking on is the evolution of Australian government.
Right.
Where we have a unique federation, which we arrived at by a very torrid process, in which a number of places actually featured very strongly, and I'm thinking of the Murray River areas. So I wonder if you could comment on, are we going to see that theme come through subliminally, or have you left it to someone else?
Yeah, it is. Look, it is one, I have to say, that other institutions do strongly pick up, particularly Old Parliament House now is very strongly, you know, defining itself as a museum of political history, really. However, it certainly does play through Creating a Country and indeed other exhibitions in the museum. For example, I think the way we decided to think about federation is rather than doing an exhibition on the kind of process of federation, say, and then the kind of evolution of the Commonwealth government out of that, is to look, if you like, at what some of the broader effects of that were. So, for example, the exhibit in the gallery that centres on Old Parliament House really looks at Old Parliament House as a site of parliamentary democracy and what that actually means and what people's ambitions for that have been in Australia. So it looks, for example, at the kind of the development of a kind of Commonwealth Parliament seat following the process of federation and the decision to create a particular kind of Commonwealth Parliament, and then looks at that place as a focus for efforts of various groups of Australians to address issues around representation and rights and those kinds of struggles. So we've tried to, I guess, kind of look, rather than saying, you know, this is the process about the evolution of Parliament and government, to say this is a seat in which is kind of a physical manifestation of this ambition, and this is then how people have participated in shaping it and, by extent, shaping the Parliament and the governmentary process. Faster, Belinda, faster.
Just one more quick question.
Yeah.
And this is general to the museum, perhaps you can answer that, I'm not sure, is whether the referencing providences and links for your research will be available on the internet.
This is a question for the museum more broadly. Look, this is certainly something we're moving towards as pretty much as fast as we can. certainly we are, so for example, around Australian Journeys, we are looking at a number of ways and trying to implement some of them as quickly as we can, that we can make really the deeper research and, as you say, the links to the sources and so on that have shaped the gallery more readily available for those people who want to, if you like, you know, go away and read more or locate more. And there are a number of ways we're looking at that. The web is certainly the major way, I think, although we're also looking at, for example, the way in which we might produce certain kinds of publications that carry some of that material. And I think that we're certainly trying to move increasingly to kind of bring that material out and have that material up on the website more quickly. And also the other sections of the museum, for example, our education section and so on, are certainly working towards, you know, building, say, for example, programs and making material available online that grows out of the permanent galleries, which are a better investment for us, frankly. If you've got a gallery up for 10 years, it's worthwhile investing in doing all these ancillary products. If you've got a temporary exhibition up for 3 months, it's not such a great investment. But if you've got ideas about how you would like to see that material delivered, that would be really good to actually communicate to the museum. So, sorry, it's one more there? No?
Thank you for your presentation. Will the notes you've used tonight be available at any time?
Oh, the written bits. I could tidy them up and they're a bit of a mess. Yes, I can make them available if you like. That's all right. Yeah, no problem. Oh, it'll be on the website. You can listen to it all over again. Is that right? Will it be a transcript or just the words or...?
Sometimes it gets transcribed, but at least the audio on demand, you'll have to talk to
them. Okay, all right. I shall investigate.
Thank you.
Oh, there's one more.
Just a quick one. When will Nation Gallery be closed down?
Look, the date for this is still a bit tentative. We're currently looking at the end of this year, the beginning of next year. But I have to stress that that is a little bit tentative because essentially, if you think about how you schedule building an exhibition, we kind of have to do the design work first to figure out exactly what we're building before we actually know how long it's going to take us to build it. And once we know how long it's going to take us to build the new gallery, then we can figure out when we actually need to close Nation in order to do that. But it's currently scheduled for really early in 2010.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.